What the hell is White Claw, you ask?
What is White Claw?
Well, this whole episode of That Chapter Podcast is not sponsored by White Claw, but if White Claw is listening, and I know they are, I'm actually a High Noon guy. I think it's much nicer than White Claw.
What's High Noon?
So Keith doesn't know what White Claw is. White Claw is, it's like a seltzer. Shite Claw.
Seltzer, okay.
It's just fizzy water. Fizzy water with some vodka in it, and it's vaguely flavored like pineapple or whatever the fuck you want to drink.
Okay, so it is alcoholic.
It is alcoholic, yes. Nice. Yeah, it's it doesn't really taste of anything much at all.
Oh, that's dangerous.
Yeah, oh, it is. You can slam them back. Easy peasy. You could pound them all day long. It's good when you're hungover, they're good to drink. I like to drink them hungover, yeah. And if I want to keep drinking,
yeah,
you know, like you're at a thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're great because, you know, sometimes like, woof, beer, woof. And you go, oh, yeah, it's great.
I feel though, especially when you're hungover, like the hair of the dog, that first beer is so hard to get down. Mm-hmm. But once you get that first beer down,
yeah, oh, you're good to go. You're golden. Yeah, 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 you're loosey-goosey, baby. Yeah.
I heard one time, I think it was around Christmas, and the next day we went to the pub, and I swear to God, I nursed my Guinness for about an hour.
Yeah.
It was like, it was so flat. It was warm. It was horrible by the end of it. But literally, as soon as that last mouthful went down, I was like, whoa, another beer, let's go.
Yeah, I'm alive again. I'm ready. You know? Yeah, I'm ready to rock and roll. All right. Yeah, yeah. Well, now you know what White Claw is. You can try it if you want. I think there's a couple in the fridge.
I find it with those beers.
It's no Carlsberg.
Yeah, it's no Carlsberg. Yeah. I feel with those fruity, I try to stay away from them just because they're too easy to drink. It doesn't feel like I need to feel like I'm drinking alcohol to slow me down.
Right, right. Because like you would pan this.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you'd be sipping that easy.
Dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, speaking of dangerous, let's talk about today's story. Oh, by the way, first I actually should just check something real quick. Check.
Check.
Check. Check.
Check. Check. Check. Check.
Check.
Check. Please.
Check. Can you hear me?
Can I hear? Yeah, I can hear you.
Listener? No, I'm talking to the listener. Listener, can you hear? Listener, can you hear me? Listener, respond. Please respond. I need to know if you can hear me. Listener. I don't know if they can hear me or not.
I don't know.
Listener, if you can hear me right now, let me know in the comments below.
If not, it's too late.
You can let me know by giving a 5-star review on Spotify. All right, today we are talking about the case of DJS. That's what I like to call it. Dorothy James. This is a wild ass story.
I am really looking forward to getting into
this. Me too.
This is crazy, the story.
Yeah, I've wanted to cover this one for a while. Actually, I wanted to cover it for years on the channel, but I can never find an interesting way. This is a story that's better suited for audio than for like visual. It's like something out of a goddamn movie. That's how batshit this. Like, I remember I was reading it. Like, it was just years ago. I think it was just like on a Wikipedia or some shit. And I was like, somebody's bullshit. Like, this case couldn't have actually happened the way it plays out. Because it's way too much out of a horror movie to be reality. And the killer, like, getting away. Well, spoiler alert. But you know what I mean? Like, much random shit happens.
Yeah.
And it ends, like, just horrifyingly.
It's terrifying. Like when I was researching it, I do all my research at night because I work during the day. So then I do it all night, and there was like I had to stop a couple of times because like 11:30, 12 o'clock at night, like I'm like, oh, getting chills. Ooh. You feel like someone's in the house watching you. I was like, no, don't like
well,
this.
Well, speaking of in the house watching you, any ghost stories? We haven't heard from the thing. Although actually, spoiler, not spoiler, I don't know what the fuck I'm saying, but somebody commented or DM'd me, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who it is, but they said that they saw like the camera shaking and shit in the video, the listener stories video we did. By the way, also somebody asked where can they watch the listener stories video. Just go into YouTube and type in That Chapter Podcast. Mm-hmm. It'll come up.
It's all there.
It's a separate YouTube channel from the That Chapter one, but it's related, so they'll come up together. Mm. Also, if you go to the That Chapter YouTube channel, my main channel, on the homepage at the bottom, I link to it.
Yeah. Somebody else, my wife, she was reading through the comments. She said that somebody said that they could hear like a child's voice, and they were like, "Oh, it must be his daughter is in the house." She wasn't in the house.
Yeah,
I thought, she like because we went out after for a drink.
We
so
did.
I sent her off to the old grandparents to be babysitted. So there was no child in the house at the time. So okay. If you hear the child's voice,
I didn't know that.
I don't know who it was. It wasn't my child.
Because I did hear some weird noises. Like, I think it's even in the video that, like, I did hear. I mean, but again, it's like, it's an old house, you know, like, it could be a million different things.
Yeah, just the normal bumps.
I would like it to be a ghost.
Night. Me too.
I think it would be cool.
Yeah.
Again, I've said this a million times, I'd love to have a ghostly experience, but I always am just like, nah, it's pretty a pipe or something. I wish I could be one of those guys who's like, the orbs, you know, like this fucking lame-ass Zach Baggins shit, where you're like, oh, somebody's speaking to me, I feel a dark presence. And I was like, no, you fucking don't, you absolute idiot.
Yeah.
But I wish I could be like that.
Yeah,
you know,
no,
to believe
this
shit.
Yeah.
But I'm like, nah.
I'd love it, but I'm still highly skeptical. But there has been some weird stuff that's happened previously in the house that I'm just like, I'm trying to like rationalize it and explain. I'm like, I can't explain that one. That's a weird one.
Yeah. What happened most recently?
We've had like the normal bumps and knocks in the night, you know, just, but again, that could be jot up to an old house.
It's an old house and it's a terraced house. It could be just the neighbors.
Running. I did have one weird one only yesterday, actually. You'd be in my house and where, you know, where my office is.
Yes, your office is on the first floor. Second floor.
Yeah, at the front of the house. And I sit right beside a window. Yeah, which is over our front door.
So overlooking the front, yeah, of your house.
And I heard a knock on. I was waiting for my wife to come home from work, so I heard a knock on the door, and it was just one big on the door at that.
Yeah.
And I thought it was my wife coming back. I'm like, okay, I'll go down and let her in. And I looked at the window, and there's nothing. I couldn't see anyone there. I was like, maybe she's right up against the door. So I went down, opened it, no one there. It was definitely 100% our door that got knocked. Again, it's just one of those things. I can't explain it. I don't know. What happened? I sit by the window, and as soon as I heard it, I looked out the window, and there was nothing there.
The ghost hasn't been let in. I'm on, honey, I'm on.
You know, come on in.
All right.
I forgot my key.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks. So you heard the ghost is back. You let him back in. He remembered the other day he tried to leave.
With
the door handle.
Yeah, yeah.
He's
yeah.
back.
Ah, shoot.
Because you haven't had any stories in a while.
I haven't. No, it has been kind of quiet, which has been nice. But yeah,
well,
I'll keep you updated, man.
The
keep
ghost.
Updated.
Is
we need to tempt them back with an Ouija board or something.
Yeah. I'd be down to try a Ouija board, I guess. But again, as we said, you won't let me do it in your house. And I'm definitely not letting you do it in my house. So
there's a cool thing you can do. It's, what are they called? It's called a ghost box, I think it is. Basically, it's like a scan. It's like a radio that scans through like AM and FM radio. So it's like you hack the radio, so it just scans through all the frequencies, and so you have like, and like it picks up certain radio stations, so it says words as you're going through, like hello, you know. But ghost hunters use it because you can actually hear what.
I already know this is the stupidest shit I've ever heard in my life.
It sounds mad, but I've seen videos and it's very creepy when you watch videos.
Of course, I mean, you're hearing static and then random words from radio stations.
But you ask questions and then the words you hear back.
You hear back what you want to hear.
I know, but that's why it'd be good.
Okay, that's a good point, actually. Yeah, I know this is bullshit, but it's good. I'm still getting scared. All right, well, you know what isn't bullshit and is scary is the story we are talking about today, the story of Dorothy Jane Scott. Dorothy Jane Scott was born on April 23rd, 1948, making her 32 years old in May 1980. That's when our tale of woe, dude, takes place. And it definitely takes place because it's in California. California. Dorothy Dot, she was living with her aunt and four-year-old son Shanty, Sean Scott, in a place called Stanton, California. See, Dorothy, she was a hard-working single mom, and she was working secretarial jobs for two different businesses, but they were jointly owned. They were Anaheim-based stores. One was a Custom John's head shop, Custom John's get head shop, and the other was Swinger's Psych Shop, which focused on an alternative crowd, but was more about hippie lifestyle and psychedelic aesthetic items rather than bongs and marijuana, Mary Jane, ooh, devil's lettuce, paraphernalia that stocks the shelves of traditional head shops. So as Dorothy, she worked two jobs, but they were in kind of similar, two hippie stores, basically. Yeah. It's probably the easy way of saying where she worked, which is ironic, because Dorothy herself, despite working for such businesses and being a very non-judgmental person in general, she was by all accounts very straight, a narc, you know what I'm saying? Conservative, quiet, very religious. Not the type you would think who would work at like kind of like a hippie weed store. But listen, hey, listen, $20 is $20. So, you know,
that's it, man. You gotta do what you gotta do. Make gotta those do. Dollar bills, yo.
Exactly. But there was no drink or certainly no drugs for Dorothy. Her father, Jacob Scott, he was also a part owner of the psych shop. So one of two stores she worked for. So there was also like a family connection with her occupations.
There was a time in Ireland, anyway, when, remember, like, there was those head shops everywhere.
I remember back in the, again, 2000s. Yeah. I remember they all shut down.
Did it? Yeah.
Did the law change?
Well, they started selling bath salts and other shit to give you like a legal high. So yeah, the government, they cracked down on it, and fairly quickly a lot of them just shut down. And there's still a few that like sell like kind of what you're saying there, like hippie crap and a couple of bongs.
Yeah.
But they're not really bongs. They're like
It's a decorative glass object. Yeah, that's exactly it. So now the story of what happened to Dorothy. This story's fucking insane, and I mean that in the worst, most terrifying way. So here's some, folks. Even without the horrors that would eventually unfold, and we will get to all of those horrors. It's fair to say that May 28th, 1980, that date would have likely stuck in the memories of Dorothy Scott's co-workers for quite a while. It was an eventful day, even without the things we're going to end up talking about in particular. See, what happened on that day? You know, it would have been any ordinary one if only a spider bite hadn't happened. A spider bite is what kicks off a terrifying mystery that has endured for more than 40 years now. It really is like something straight out of a movie. A guy got bit by a spider and that kicks off this
whole chain of events.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you remember this, but you're... Back when we were wee lads,
mm-hmm.
your brother got bit by a spider.
Did he?
Yeah, well, he said he did. Like, after, like, Ireland, like, I think our most dangerous animal is, like, a badger.
Oh, yeah, he got bit. It was a house spider.
Was that what it was?
Yeah.
Anyway, he convinced me that he was going to be Spider-Man, and I fully believe him.
Yeah, he definitely did, because you're an idiot. No, so in Ireland, for the folks at home, we have, like, house spiders. They're pretty big. They can get pretty big.
They get big.
Well, I mean, you know, a couple of inches. Like, not, like, Australian big, but big enough that they're mildly, give you a jump if you see it sometimes. Yeah. But they're extremely docile. Like, they're not aggressive. They're not poisonous either.
Mm.
They're, you know, more scared of you than you are of them. But yeah, I remember I was there. It was on the floor trying to run away from him. He was playing with it. Like, it would run away and put his hand out, and it would run the other way and put his hand out. So eventually just bit him. But it's like a bee sting.
Yeah, that's why, because he showed me. He was like, look at that. And he showed me, like, these tiny little black marks in his hands. Like, that's a spider bite.
Yeah.
I'm going to be Spider-Man. I was like, whoa.
No shit.
So cool.
Yeah. So, Dorothy's usual routine of dropping her son off at her parents' house in Anaheim, her parents, Jacob and Vera. She would usually do this while attending a 9 p.m. staff meeting at one of her jobs. That routine took a sharp departure when Dorothy noticed that one of her co-workers, a guy named Conrad Bostron, he was looking a little bit under the weather, more under the weather than usual, and he was nursing a sore-looking red mark on his arm. So after some persuading, Dorothy and another co-worker, a woman named Pam Head, they left the meeting early to take Bostron to the nearby emergency room. This was at UC Irving Medical Center.
Dorothy, she drove Bostron in her car.
Yes.
I don't know why Pam was there. She was clearly just trying to get off work.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, it was a staff meeting at 9 p.m. at night. Who was a staff meeting at 9 p.m?
That's a late meeting for a head job.
Very late meeting.
What are you talking about?
I have no idea, but it's weird.
Yeah.
But yeah, exactly. As you say, Pam, there's no real reason for her to go. She was taking...
She was like, fuck this.
Yeah, she's like, all right.
I'll go with you.
Yeah, why not? Yeah. Get anything to get out of this meeting. Though Bostron was unwell, his arm a little bit tender, he wasn't exactly on his deathbed. So Dorothy, she took a few minutes on the way to the hospital to stop off at her parents' house to check in with her son, let them know she'd be home later than expected, as she had to go to the hospital. It was a quick in and out visit, right? But there was one seemingly innocuous decision by Dorothy at this point, which would later become a pivotal moment in her life. She changed the scarf she was wearing. For whatever reason, Dorothy swapped the red scarf she had been wearing to a white scarf. Naturally, the only people who were aware of this were Pam Head and Conrad Bostron. Though, just how much attention Bostron was paying to anything other than the big spider bite in his arm, who knows?
Ah, my arms. Oh, nice scarf.
Yeah, exactly. That is fabulous. Unbeknownst to the three co-workers at the time, but soon to be revealed at the hospital, Conrad Bostron was actually suffering the effects of a black widow bite. Yeah, the red mark on his arm was a spider bite from a bona fide black ass widow. So with time being of the essence, staff at UC Irving treated Bostron urgently, and within an hour of arriving at the medical center, he was already well on the mend, having been given, you know, anti-venom and was being prepped to be discharged from the hospital. A quick aside about black widow bites. For those at home, they're not actually very deadly at all, insofar as most people who are bitten do survive their bite, unless their health is already somehow compromised. Between the 2 to 4 people that die every year, that's, you know, out of 2,500 people, though, who are bitten. It's not like, you know, Australian funnel web or a Brazilian wandering spider where it's like super dangerous and you need to get that treated. If you're not a baby or if you're not like a very old person, you'll be fine. This is even despite the fact that a black widow bite, it's up to 15 times stronger than rattlesnake venom. But I mean, yeah, it's not going to be pleasant. You should go to the hospital if you get bitten by a black widow, but it's not like, oh my God, you're going to die. It's like, yeah, you'll be fine.
You'll probably survive.
Yeah. Symptoms of widow bites include soreness, swelling around the injury, as well as severe aches and pains throughout the upper body, particularly the chest and shoulders, and also experiencing horrendous abdominal pain. So it's no bueno, but it's not, you know, terribly deadly.
Do you know that cows are actually more dangerous than black widow spiders statistically?
Cows kill more people?
Yeah, they kill about 20 people each year by either like in the US by either kicking or trampling.
Wow.
But one of the most dangerous animal of them all
is human.
The deer.
The deer.
That's right. Fear the deer, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Each year, deer cause about 1.3 million car accidents and about 200 of them are fatal.
Yeah. Well, it's also an animal that has knives on its head.
Imagine it was just one deer, like a serial killer deer.
Yeah, exactly. Killing I wouldn't fuck with a deer. Yeah, no way. I wouldn't fuck around with a deer at all. Don't fuck with that shit. No way.
They are dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Clearly, they kill 200 people a year.
Yeah, exactly. We need to kill more deer.
Well, just that one deer. That's serial killer deer.
Right, that's fair.
I don't know why we haven't caught him yet. It's ridiculous.
So by 11 p.m., feeling much better, but still drained and a little unsteady on his feet, Conrad Bostrand was given a prescription and he was ready to leave the hospital, his spider bite well and truly healed, or on the way to being healed. Dorothy and Pamhead, they had been in the waiting room of the medical center while Conrad was being treated, neither of them leaving the other's sight, probably just happy to get out of that staff meeting. Dorothy and Pam quickly decided between themselves that Bostrand shouldn't walk too far and he definitely shouldn't be left alone. The plan was for Pam to help, you know, and get the prescription filled and then walk Bostrand to the entrance of the hospital while Dorothy would go to the bathroom before retrieving her car from the parking lot, pulling up at the front of the medical center, minimizing the stress on Conrad Bostrand. So Pam, she would help Conrad while Dorothy would have the engine running outside and be ready to go. Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Pam fulfilled her side of things. She got the prescription and the man himself to the entrance of the medical center. But that, my friends, is when the story goes from kind of strange, but not that weird, to what the frick just happened. So, Pam and Conrad were waiting outside, but Dorothy was a no-show and getting restless after an almost 20-minute wait, which a weirdly long time. Dorothy, all she had to do was get the car ready from the parking lot and meet them at the entrance, which she should have been there waiting for him, essentially. So after waiting a full 20, and this was in the very wee hours of the morning, pitch black outside, that's when Pam finally saw Dorothy's car, a white 1973 Toyota station wagon, coming straight at the two of them with its headlights almost blinding them. Both Pam and Bostrand, they waved at the car, but not only did the car not stop and pull up for them, it practically flew past them and out of the car park. Now, this was a long time, as you can imagine, before everyone had a cell phone, so Pam and Bostrand, they were a little confused by why the plan suddenly changed and why Dorothy seemingly had hauled ass out of the parking lot and the hospital when, you know, they were right there. But they assumed maybe Dorothy must have been some kind of emergency with her son or something like that. Though then again, how would Dorothy know? She didn't have a cell phone.
Yeah.
But, you know, they assumed there must have been something that had her racing out of
the
place.
She wouldn't have just left them.
Yeah, there is some logical explanation. So they ended up waiting at the hospital for a couple of hours, thinking that, you know, eventually Dorothy would come back and pick them up. It wasn't until the even weir hours of the morning that Pamhead called Jacob and Vera Scott, Dorothy's parents, to find out if Dorothy had turned up there at home to pick up her son.
It was a long time they waited, wasn't it?
Yeah, a couple of hours. Yeah. You think they would have done it pretty quickly after she'd left.
Yeah, like no, I don't think they're involved in anyway. I just think it's strange that, like, how long they waited. Like, I looked up the distance between the Swingers psych shop and UC Irvine Medical Center. It's only 11-minute drive. I don't know why they didn't get a taxi. Mm. Especially after, like, the first hour. But, like, I don't think she's coming back.
It'd be pretty easy to call a cab for the hospital, but yeah. So when Pam called Dorothy's parents to see if she had showed up to collect her son, she hadn't. The phone call home elevated everyone's concerns right away, and Pam called the police to report Dorothy missing. By all accounts, with Dorothy being an adult, the report wasn't exactly taken seriously, let alone made a priority like it would, you know, expect it to be. That all changed, however, a couple of hours later, when Dorothy's car was found in an alleyway in Santa Ana, about 10 minutes from the medical center. Someone had burned it out, and Dorothy was nowhere to be found. Now, that phone call, the phone call from Pam to Dorothy's parents, was not the very first phone call to cause alarm. In fact, there had been quite a few phone calls. The case of Dorothy Jane Scott had actually begun months before her disappearance from the medical center on May 28, 1980. It began with a series of phone calls to Dorothy herself from some mystery man. The mystery caller alternated between two extremes, but both were equally creepy for very different reasons. See, in one call, this mystery phone caller would put on a face of a misguided romantic pursuer, professing his love for Dorothy and telling her, you know, how much he adored her and wanted to be her. But by the time of the next call, he'd seemingly done a 180 and was all the way now in downtown Crazy Town. Now he wanted to kill Dorothy, but he kept the same reserved tone he'd used to tell her how beautiful she was. He wasn't too shy about describing his fantasies, whichever end of the spectrum he was feeling at the time. Think of the calls, you know, in Scream when Ghostface calls the victim before he kills her. That's kind of like what you should have in your mind. Mm. It's probably, in fact, maybe that was probably inspiration for this. Because yeah. This case is like straight out of a horror movie.
Yeah.
Though Dorothy nor her mother could ever put a name to whoever the caller was, Dorothy always said she recognized the voice. Again, she couldn't put a name to it, but something about that voice felt familiar. Like she'd heard it before, just couldn't place it after racking her brain.
That's terrifying.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure there was like many sleepless nights where just trying to figure out where she knew the voice from.
Yeah.
I was reading a book called The Anatomy of a Stalker, which said in a study, 98% of female victims were stalked by someone they knew. It's male victims that are more likely than female victims to be stalked by a complete stranger. So it's extremely likely that Dorothy had some interaction with this person at some point, which is why she obviously recognized the voice.
Yeah. And this unidentified male caller, he knew things, intimate details about Dorothy's routine, things he shouldn't know, things he would only know if he was following her. At first, she was able to wave off the calls. But her mother, Vera, said that Dorothy's attitude changed after one particularly frightening call in which the stalker told Dorothy he wanted to, quote, kill her and chop her body into bits so no one would ever find her. On one occasion, the caller told Dorothy he had left something for her, and when she went outside, she found a dead red rose on the windshield of her car. Now, Dorothy, she was a smart girl, smart woman. She took the threat seriously. She began changing her routine, even began karate lessons for self-defense. Her mother told investigators and the press shortly after she disappeared that her daughter had been so concerned that right before her kidnapping, she'd been considering buying a gun, something she never would have entertained prior to receiving the calls. But now she's ready to blast away some bastard, and I don't think there's much wrong with that.
Absolutely. Get two guns.
Yeah,
that's what I
exactly.
Say. More times than not, stalking is like a precursor to domestic violence or sexual assault. This guy, he was clearly very obsessed with Dorothy and looking to gain control over her. And like things were escalating very quickly, mm-hmm. especially like I said, dropping off the rose, dropping off gifts and stuff. As a quick side note, observation, California, it was crawling with these types of stalkers. Killers
hey,
in
listen,
the 1980s.
They don't call a Holly weird for no reason, am I right? That's a little joke for the folks in the biz. That's what we call the entertainment business.
Oh, so, okay.
Yeah,
I didn't know.
Just to be clear.
But like, yeah, there are like some famous ones as well. Like there was Richard Ramirez. He was literally called the Night Stalker, and he committed a series of murders and sexual assaults in California between 84 and 85. The Golden State Killer. He also stalked and killed at least 13 people across California in the 70s and 80s, and he also called up some of the victims to terrorize them. And it was David Carpenter. He stalked and murdered a number of people on hiking trails.
Covered that. He's an alumni of the That Chapter podcast. I don't think you were in that episode, but
I
cover it.
And yeah, that happened in California as well in 79 and 81. So I don't know, what the hell was going on in California at the time?
Yeah, just something in the water.
Yeah, mad. Yeah. Just stalking, killing. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. But what absolutely nobody expected, right, was all the calls Dorothy had been receiving prior to her being taken. The calls continued after she was taken or whatever happened. Just a week after Dorothy was taken, kidnapped, disappeared, Vera Scott, Dorothy's mother, answered the phone and a male voice she didn't know asked her if she was related to Dorothy Scott. When Vera said she was, the man simply replied, "I've got her," before he hung up. While those few brief words might have been horrifying to Vera, they were actually welcomed by officers investigating Dorothy's case. The phone call was the first potential break in a case sorely lacking on any kinds of leads. She was last seen in the hospital, then her car was found burnt out. The police had nothing to go on as to what actually happened to Dorothy herself. And Dorothy wasn't the usual kind of disappeared authorities, you know, were used to. Dorothy didn't have enemies. She didn't indulge in any sort of high-risk behavior. As we said, she was a pretty straight-laced, conservative person. She didn't even date very much. They just couldn't get a handle on where to even start looking as to what could have happened to her. Now, the obvious starting point for most people was with 4-year-old Sean's father, her baby daddy, a guy named Dennis Terry. Unfortunately, though, for investigators hoping to wrap things up quickly, Terry was 2,000 miles away at his home in Missouri at the time of Dorothy's disappearance. The latest call at least gave investigators a tread to grab on and a faint hope that Dorothy may still be alive. The hope was quickly painted over with frustration as another week passed without any progress. Vera and Jacob Scott were growing more and more frustrated, leading Jacob to contact the Orange County Register, which is a local paper. Up until now, Dorothy's parents had heeded the police's advice to keep the kidnapping out of the press. But with no significant advancements in the investigation, and with time very much being of the essence, Jacob decided to go against the detective's recommendations and, you know, to try and get the public involved in the search for his daughter. The next day, the paper ran an article about Dorothy's disappearance and the calls, multiple, they had been receiving since. They also wrote that Jacob and Vera had offered a $25,000 award for anyone who could lead to the return of their daughter. Unfortunately, the only call of interest wasn't too concerned with the rewards or helping find Dorothy. It was from the stalker turned kidnapper themselves. For the first time, rather than Vera or Dorothy, it was the Register's editorial manager, a guy named Pat Riley. He was on the other end of the phone after the front desk redirected a call. This caller told Pat Riley, "I killed her. I killed Dorothy Scott. She was my love. I caught her cheating with another man. She denied having someone else. I killed her." Whatever chance there was that the caller was simply a crazy person who wanted attention and not the killer threat they were making out, that was easily ruled out when the caller confirmed himself to be Dorothy's kidnapper by mentioning a crucial detail. The scarf. Scarf that Dorothy changed from red to white when she stopped off at her parents' house on the way to the medical center. Like I mentioned earlier, only two other people would have known that Dorothy was wearing the white scarf when she was taken. The stalker also knew about Conrad's spider bite. Again, something very few people outside of Dorothy's immediate circle would have known. It's like the spider bite whole aspect of this case is a bizarre little sprinkle on top, but it's also so random. No one, who would know?
You can't predict it.
You cannot predict somebody's going to get bitten by a spider and that will lead to this bizarre circumstance. And I'm not sure I need to tell you, the whole cheating thing was obviously a complete figment of this man's, a madman's imagination. Not only did she have no obligation, obviously, to this crazy person, Dorothy, it's not believed she was seeing anybody. She wasn't believed to have been in a relationship, or at least a public known relationship at the time of her disappearance. It seems that either she had a secret side or this guy was just more likely a delusional, insane person.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. This case is so terrifying. So she had a stalker who was serious, we can assume, after leaving a dead rose outside her house. Then we can assume it's probably the same person who escalates and escalates until kidnapping her. But how he kidnapped her is just absolutely insane. Like, if it was her normal routine, I mean, she'd already been changing her routine anyway. But if it was her normal routine when she was taken, that kind of would have made sense. Someone had been watching her, knew when she would be most vulnerable. But she was kidnapped when she was so far outside of her normal routine and so far removed from where she would normally go while at the hospital for a friend's spider bite.
Yeah.
Like, of all the times to be kidnapped, then and there, when nobody could have predicted this would have happened.
Yeah.
It's insane. Like, how would the killer know? Was the killer following her? I mean, it's weird. He must have, I mean, either he was following her or the only explanation is the killer was, like, again, like an urban legend, hiding in the trunk of her car the entire time.
Terrifying.
And then he pops out.
There's a lot of speculation about how the killer knew she was on her way to the hospital. And that's definitely like one of the weirdest parts of the case, as you've been saying. I reckon it's connected to them stopping at Dorothy's parents' place real quick to check on Sean before
and
heading out.
Her scarf.
Yeah, I think maybe the killer was hanging around near Dorothy's parents' house, just waiting. You know, like he was just there for a regular night of stalking.
Yeah, right, because she'd have to go there and collect her son.
Yeah, so I guess he kind of knew that she'd be there eventually. So he was kind of waiting outside, watching the house, waiting for her to arrive. Then all of a sudden she arrives, jumps out of a car, goes in, checks on, and then comes straight back out and gets into a car with a man. And then he's like, fuck this, and then follows him and end up at the hospital. I personally think that's maybe what happened, but I don't know.
That would make sense. I hear you're barking, big dog. he would have seen her with another man there, and that could have spurned like the jealousy thing.
Yeah,
come
from
that. That's
especially because he was saying that like she cheated and stuff.
Yeah. When this guy's like profusely sweating, on the life. He's got like a swollen arm. Yeah. Then almost every Wednesday afternoon for almost 4 years, from 1980 to 1984, the calls to the Scott family home continued. Strangely, the caller seemed to show even more knowledge of their routine by calling when he did. He never called. He never, ever called when Jacob, the father, was home. And every call followed a similar script with the man telling Vera he had killed Dorothy. The calls finally only stopped after the man apparently made a mistake and called later than usual one evening in April 1984. This time the call was actually answered by Jacob. The man hung up straight away. And he never called back. Now, I've seen some people have been speculating that this is because the caller could have been worried that Jacob would have recognized the voice and called them out. That Vera and Dorothy were both saying, oh, that sounds kind of familiar. Jacob would have been like, I know who that is.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Though that hasn't been confirmed officially as a line of investigation. It's purely down to amateur sleuths. It does seem like that's the most likely thing, is that the fear of being discovered was enough to scare off this mystery man.
Yeah. It's such a messed up thing to do as well. It's like he's moving on from normal stalking, if that's a thing, to like victim stalking.
Yeah.
Where he was now tormenting the family, seeming to prolong their suffering of their grieving.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say it was kind of like a power and control thing.
So yeah.
Stalking the victim's family allowed him to continue exerting power and control over those connected to the victim. And also he was, you know, a sadistic fuck, just getting pleasure from causing fear, pain and suffering. So one messed up dude, man.
Yeah, absolutely. In an interview with an LA paper, fighting off tears, the usually stoic Jacob Scott told a reporter that he and Vera just wanted some kind of closure. Even if that meant just getting their daughter's remains back so they could give her a, quote, proper Christian burial. It was on August 6th, 1984, 4 years after Dorothy Scott was kidnapped. Shortly after 7 a.m., a team from Macau Construction Company was preparing to lay down some pipe on behalf of Pacific Bell telephone lines under Santa Ana Canyon Road when their foreman, Jesse Lowe's, joked that they should be careful not to find any dead bodies. The joke would be on Jesse, as shortly after he and his team began finding bones strewn across the site. Most appeared to be small animal bones, but a few were undeniably from something much bigger than a pet. The bones had been bleached from the sun and were scattered over an area of approximately 25 square feet, which would indicate animal activity. They consisted of an intact skull along with teeth, complete with fillings and dental work, as well as both femurs, pelvis, and upper arms. The small bones thought to be from an animal were exactly that, dog bones. Despite the dog bones initially being presumed to be related to Dorothy's, most investigators and commentators on the case now seem to have reached a consensus that the dog bones found with Dorothy Scott's were more likely completely unrelated to Scott or the killer or whatever really happened. Though, of course, the possibility they were also put there by the same person who ended Dorothy's life will also remain. That could be the killer escalating from animals to people.
Personally, I think the killer put the dog there.
Yeah.
I think he was so obsessed with Dorothy that I feel he may have like frequently revisited the scene of the crime where he dumped the body as a way to, you know, reaffirm his dominance even after death. I'm guessing like the dog was his and then he dumped it there also after the dog died. I am, of course, saying this with absolutely zero evidence. It's always a wild guess.
It's good though. It was the presence of the pelvis that gave investigators their first immediate piece of information about the previous lady owner, as the female and male pelvis, they vary pretty greatly. Even to the naked eye, albeit a trained eye, it can usually be discerned with a fair amount of certainty which sex the pelvis belonged to. In this case, investigators brought in an anthropologist from Cal State Fullerton to help ascertain the age and sex of the remains. Using dental records, the Orange County Coroner's Office was able to confirm what the investigators had already deduced. The bones belonged to Dorothy Scott, and the bones had been there for at least 2 years prior to being discovered. Detectives had been expecting the confirmation for some time, as Vera and Jacob had already identified a ring with a large turquoise stone and wristwatch, both found close to the remains as belonging to Dorothy. Some of her items still remained right there. When news of Dorothy's bones being found finally hit the papers, the Scott family phone began to ring once again. The stalker would ask, Is Dorothy there? A sick joke, obviously. In a fluke of the most ironic tragedy, Jacob Scott passed away on April 23rd, 1994, the day that his daughter would have been celebrating her 46th birthday. Vera Scott passed away in 2002. The couple kept the same phone number, hoping that one day they might be finally able to find out who killed their daughter. But to date, the case remains unsolved and is currently in the hands of the Orange County Sheriff's Office and their cold case team.
Honestly, this is like one of the most terrifying cases that I've
researched. Yeah, it really, really is. It's so bizarre. It doesn't make any sense. The killer calling back.
I think that's it. I think it's because the killer, he was just so cruel and relentless. He was going to get Dorothy no matter what. And then when he finally did, it still wasn't enough. He continued to be this like dark shadow on Dorothy's family so he could continue his like sick psychological sadism.
Torture.
There are a couple of theories out there about who it could be, but one interesting one came actually from Sean Scott, Dorothy's son, who shared his suspicion with a crime blogger who reached out to him. The suspect was, he reckons, it was this like unstable man. He worked as a mechanic next door or across the street from swingers and had apparently he was involved in cult activity.
I love the cult shit. Classic. It's great. Classic. I mean, like,
it is the 80s, so.
Yeah, you know, oh, right, yeah, yeah. Big satanic panic.
Yeah. But apparently, according to several of Dorothy's friends, he was absolutely obsessed with her. And really? His sister worked with Dorothy at Swingers. So this is all completely unsubstantiated. And apparently the police, they were aware of the man at the time, but they never had enough evidence to consider him a suspect or even a person of interest. But according to Dorothy's son, that's who he reckons it was. An interesting point to this whole thing, actually. So the first anti-stalking law actually passed in California in 1990.
Wow.
So this was following the high-profile case of actress Rebecca Schaefer. She was stalked and murdered by an obsessed fan in 1989. So before the passage of the anti-stalking laws, prosecuting cases of stalking was challenging, as there were no specific statutes addressing this kind of behavior. Instead, prosecutors, they relied on like existing laws related to harassment, trespassing, or other offense like intimidation,
right,
which might not have been adequately addressed the seriousness of the stalking behavior. So before specific anti-stalking laws were enacted, consequences for stalking behavior, they were often less severe and did not, you know, like fully address the psychological impact and the ongoing threat posed by stalkers. So I guess while Dorothy Jane Scott's case, it may not have directly led to the passage of the anti-stalking laws, I'm sure like her story definitely played a role in raising awareness, at least to the issue, and advocating for legal reforms to combat this stalking behavior.
Man, it's a bizarre-ass case. Very scary. Especially in the fact that the guy's never been caught.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's still out there.
Still out there. Yeah. Well, there you go. That is today's episode of the That Chapter podcast. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty chilling one, you know? I think this one scared me more than normal.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it's so fucked
up. It's like reading a movie. It's crazy.
It is, yeah. But unfortunately, just it's not satisfying because you don't know.
Yeah,
you still don't know.
Yeah.
But, Shanae. All right. Here, listen, folks, thanks so much for listening to me and Keith yammer away with this whole episode. New episodes of the That Chapter podcast are at every single Monday. So you check it out. Check it out real quick. And yeah, Keith's just looking at me and smiling.
Do you want a final word?
No, I don't.
Okay, fine.
Oh, no, do you have one? Have you got a zinger?
I was going to say, has anyone ever considered a spider? The Bit Bostron. Yeah, I don't trust that spider. Maybe he was in cahoots with the deer. Serial killer deer.
Okay, I shouldn't have let you have the final word.
Cut that in.
All right. Yeah. All right, folks. Thanks so much for listening, and take care of yourselves till the next episode. All right.
See ya.
Bye. Dorothy and another co-worker, a woman named Pam Head. God damn Head. That's what they say after she's in. They left the meeting early. Very shtick there.
Yeah. Palm Head and Head Shop.
I say no, Palm Head, given Head.
Oh, that's much worse.
Yes, exactly. Regina, please cut that out.